I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Selling a little or a lot? Shopify helps you do your thing however you cha-ching. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real life store stage. All the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage. Shopify is there to help you grow. Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers with the internet's best converting checkout. 36% better on average compared to other leading commerce platforms. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Get a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/work. Shopify.com/work.
Hey, Dave.
Yeah, Randy.
Since we founded Bombas, we've always said our socks, underwear, and T-shirts are super soft. Any new ideas?
Maybe sublimely soft.
Or disgustingly cozy.
Wait, what?
I got it. Bombas. Absurdly comfortable essentials for yourself.
And for those facing homelessness.
Because one purchased equals one donated.
Wow, did we just write an ad?
Yes.
Bombas. Big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase.
Come on, show me the magic.
Can I take you out to the pictures?
Well, I hope you'll come and see me in the movies.
What a scene
of your Hollywood song.
Hello, and welcome to the Beatles Films Podcast. I'm Matt Looker.
I'm Ed Williamson.
We're both professional film writers and Fab Four fans, and each week we discuss a different movie about, starring, or inspired by the Beatles. And we've reached the end of season three. This is part two of our two-part discussion on 1968's Yellow Submarine. Hopefully you've already listened to the first part released last week, and we're about to continue our discussion on the film, so let's go straight into it. One of the things that we didn't call out perhaps in our last episode was this film really looks like nothing else that came before or since.
Yeah.
Right? Like, this is a very, very unique style that I think has been parodied since, but hasn't been copied or replicated.
And
I think that's part of its sort of enduring legacy is the fact that it has such a recognizable design and stylistic tone to it.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, so if you think about what's going on with animation in the 1960s, that is a market that is pretty much entirely dominated by Disney. So they're releasing things like 101 Dalmatians, Sword in the Stone. Mary Poppins has its kind of live action and animated mix. There's the Jungle Book as well, with its own little Beatles connection in it with the
vultures.
Yeah. We'll do an episode on that one day for sure. we're going to string this out as long as we possibly can.
Series 52.
So Hanna-Barbera are kind of starting up. So there's a Yogi Bear film, which is their first feature that comes out in 1964. And then I think there's a Flintstones film a bit later on. But so basically, like, there is animation going on all around the world, like particularly in Eastern Europe and a fair amount in Japan as well. But in terms of sort of Hollywood fare, Western fare, if you like, it's completely dominated by Disney. Yellow Submarine is quite an anomaly in that regard. Doing an animated film at all is quite bold. Like, it would be the kind of thing now. Animation kind of fits in quite well in more live-action contexts now, by which I don't mean adding animation into live-action film. I mean that it's not at all uncommon these days for a sitcom, an American sitcom that's been running for ages and has those sort of 22-minute episodes and 24 episodes a year, to do something like a stop-motion episode. You know, Community did one of those. Yeah. And It's Always Sunny in Philadelphia has done one as well, I think.
Sure.
It's the kind of thing that it fits quite well in for an adult audience. And I think maybe, and of course, you know, you have things like The Simpsons and Futurama, which are intended just as much for adult audiences as they are for children.
And also actual adult animation, you know, in terms of South Park, obviously. And, yeah. You know, we've got now BoJack Horseman and Archer and, you know, all those things now. None of this stuff existed back then.
No, absolutely. So I think at the time it's quite bold for them to do this at all. And, you know, perhaps it's one of these things where, you know, we always say, oh, the Beatles changed so much and all this stuff wouldn't have happened without the Beatles. Like in this case, I think, you know, Yellow Submarine did blaze a trail in a sense, but it wasn't particularly the Beatles blazing that trail. They just sort of they said yes to some people who wanted to blaze a trail and then said, yeah, we quite like this, and then recorded a bit at the end.
I guess if you're being generous, you can say that the Beatles being the band that they were and the personalities they were and having already proven themselves in many ways to want to push boundaries creatively, that allowed the animators sort of the freedom to do a similar thing, like as an inspiration in the same way that we discussed, like the Cirque du Soleil love show in our All Together Now episode. Your approach to doing anything that's related to the Beatles in a different medium should respect the ideals that came with the Beatles in terms of being creative and having freedom of expression. So it does make sense, you know. Not saying that in the same way that we often accuse Paul of doing, to claiming credit for someone else's work. But if you are being generous, you could say that the spirit that came with the Beatles can often serve as inspiration for this type of work.
Yeah, and actually, I mean, that sort of goes along with something that's happening in the plot, in the Beatles as this kind of symbol of freedom of expression are coming up against the Blue Meanies, who are sort of... They have something in common with authoritarian regimes, the sort of cultural vandals, the Blue Meanies, who basically, like, they don't like music and they don't like joy and they don't like expression. And lots of real life authoritarian regimes, it tends to be quite common to them actually, are aware of the cultural power, the unifying power of things like music, of things like dance, you know, all those dance movies where like a kid just wants to dance, but like, you know, the mayor of the local town is banned dancing and they have to do it in secret, you know. It's like, you know, that happens in real life. No, it doesn't. But it's based on the same idea that sort of artistic expression is a threat to authority, you know, and particularly leads to, I mean, there was pandemonium whenever the Beatles came into town in real life, of course, you know. It's the kind of thing that's quite scary for an authoritarian regime. It's like, this is mayhem. It's like, we can't control this. Like, what if this power was harnessed in some way against us?
I like the idea that, you know, you're talking about Luminis having or representing like an authoritarian regime.
Yeah.
And also at the same time, this film marking a departure for other animation at the time. I like the fact that, again, you can uncover with just a bare amount of digging, that the art director, Heinz Edelman, hated Disney movies. And that's why a lot of the Blue Meanies actually have Mickey Mouse-shaped ears and Mickey Mouse-shaped hats and stuff on them.
Right,
and it just feels like they're so close to being sued, you know, because it's quite blatant once you know it. But if you don't know it, then it just feels like part of the character design.
Yeah.
But if you read that fact, you can't look at it now without being like, oh yeah, of course, this is quite a blatant attack on Disney.
That's interesting, isn't it? Being involved in animation in the 1960s and hating Disney.
Yeah.
You know, you would have thought, well, Disney is dominating animation, or at least mainstream animation, getting things released into cinemas at the time. But I suppose, you know, it sounds to me like the animators hired to work on Yellow Submarine, like the team they got together, were sort of like young, wacky, creative people, and probably a little bit anti-establishment. You know, you get that impression.
I think the other thing that comes from it as well is that again, Heinz Edelman, who by all accounts actually had quite a lot of free rein in terms of the character designs, the approach to all the animation. A lot of it comes directly from him.
Yeah.
And he was born in Czechoslovakia, and You were saying to me before we started recording this that you actually felt that some of the animation had a bit of an Eastern European quality to it,
yeah.
Which I think is present. And I think you can understand how, I guess, in a different, slightly different culture, you could see Disney as almost monopolizing that whole art medium.
Yeah.
And that you can grow resentful at that. And I think that's probably how that comes through, how the blue meanies end up wearing the Mickey Mouse hats, is just sort of this sort of pushback on this almost like Hollywoodized version of an art form that this Heinz Edelman obviously felt very passionate about.
Yeah, it's interesting, isn't it, that, you know, if he sort of resents the homogenization of communism, that it also resents the homogenization of the capitalism of yes. Disney, you know.
Yeah.
It's sort of direct opposite. He seems to have maybe found parallels between the two things.
Yeah, interesting. There are so many interesting, like, animated sequences that are happening on the screen at all times.
Yeah.
Like, you can't concentrate on everything all at once.
Mm.
But there are some standout sequences,
yeah.
I think, in the film. I think Lucy in the Sky of Diamonds is one.
Yes.
From what I understand, the it's sort of an early form of rotoscoping, which became sort of a forerunner for some of the early CGI animation in sort of later years with the likes of Tron and the use of lightsabers, I think, were rotoscoped in the first film.
Yeah.
But the idea is that you're colorizing frames at a time. And I think Lucy Sky of Diamonds sequence is particularly spectacular because, from what I understand, the whole sequence was given to several animators to colorize in different ways. And then it was all put back together again. And you can see that there's just lots of different flourishes of color and flourishes of like brush stroke and techniques,
yeah.
in them and stuff, and it just makes for quite a dazzling makes for a sort of dazzling sequence that I think lives up to the song, but in a way that, you know, a lazier way of approaching this would be to literally have Tangerine Trees and Marmalade Skies on the screen,
yeah,
right? But they don't do it down that route. They have like this, a dance sequence that is brought to life through this sort of wonderful use of color and paint.
Yeah, and I think my very, very dim understanding of how it was done is, so there's a sort of very early version of, like, you wouldn't call it motion capture, but basically, like, they are working on templates of sort of like Fred Astaire and Ginger Rogers and things like mm-hmm. that. The dance sequences are there, like, that they're basically, I'm going to say, tracing over. I know there's more to it than that, but yeah. You know, but they're just traces.
Yeah, I mean, aren't all animators traces, really?
Exactly. Get over yourselves. it adds a real sort of human element to that. Most of the sort of human or sort of humanoid characters, if you like, that you see in Yellow Submarine, they tend to be sort of quite static. So a lot of them, you know, in the sort of Victorian garb, things like that, and they will be, a lot of the time they're just kind of standing and looking. And obviously, like, a lot of that is when they've been bonked on their head by an apple, and then they've turned grey and they need waking back up to full colour, you know. But even when they are sort of awake, those characters seem to have been drawn in a static way, and then bits of their limbs move, you know. That's just how that bit of the animation works. Lucy in the Sky with Diamonds sequence seems quite distinct from that. There seems to be more movement in it.
There's more fluidity, isn't there?
More fluidity, yeah. And you can see, and actually, you know, taking sort of Fred Astaire and Ginger Rogers dance sequence, I mean, it's the best way to achieve that.
Yeah, of course. It's interesting as well what you're saying there about sort of the contrast, I think, with some of those animated styles. I was thinking, as you were saying that, about the contrast between when we first see Pepperland and then the animated sequence we see that plays underneath Eleanor Rigby,
yeah,
which is when we get to Liverpool for the first time. And it's visually striking how they create that contrast between the magical wonder fantasy fairyland of Pepperland and what is very much sort of like a gritty working class view of Liverpool, but still with sort of fantastic elements to it.
Yeah, I think this is one of the interesting things about it. The way the animation and the plot work together is that you can think of this in a sense as a sort of magic realist piece. In magic realism, typically, there'll be a character who lives in what we see as the real world, who's then introduced to a fantasy world. So say Lion, the Witch and the Wardrobe or something like that, you know, where you sort of go through some kind of portal, you know. So you could see this in that way, whereby the Beatles in Liverpool are like normal people who then travel to Pepperland, and that's the magic realism part of it. That isn't quite true because, of, as you say, there are fantastical elements to it already while they're in Liverpool. When Fred goes to visit them at their house, there's the massive long corridor and sort of egg cups and things like that, and, you know, fly around the place and whatnot.
But again, only with the Beatles. So the rest of Liverpool is played relatively straight. And I think that, you know, you mentioned Lion, Witch and the Wardrobe there. I'm actually going to evoke a comparison you made in a previous episode about a previous film, and you call that Wizard of Oz.
Right.
Because you have this sort of more sort of grim, darkened, almost black and white view of Liverpool.
Yeah.
And it's through connecting with the Beatles and the Beatles then embarking on this journey and come to Pepperland, that everything becomes full Technicolor.
Yeah,
that's how it feels. You know, the it's the Beatles bringing everything into color, which I guess kind of mirrors a lot of people's relationship with the Beatles at that time, where they saw them from, you know, black and white TV sets on, say, the Ed Sullivan Show, right the way through to the burst of color that came through with Sergeant Pepper's and Psychedelia.
Yeah, and probably quite common with how post-war Liverpool actually was. I mean, Liverpool was bombed horrifically during the war. I mean, the Beatles grew up playing on literal bomb sites, you know, just places that hadn't been rebuilt since the war, you know. And the way the film kind of depicts Liverpool, more with the had this sort of like old sort of Georgian architecture, I suppose, mainly. And then there are these sort of bits sort of poking out now and then that suggest a bit of life that's kind of going on underneath it, you know. It's no coincidence to find out that, so I mean, the first episode of Monty Python's Flying Circus came out in 1969, and Terry Gilliam has very obviously watched Yellow Submarine.
Yes.
Right. Yeah, yeah. And apparently the Eleanor Rigby sequence was a particular inspiration for him. And you can see that in that his style, at least the style he's using in those Monty Python animations, is very similar in that it is taking sort of recognisably British things a lot of the time, and then just making them very silly. You know?
Yes.
So,
but also in the actual technique of how he does that is, you know, through colorisation of still pictures.
Yeah, collage.
He animates. And also, I go so far as to say, famously calling out, I guess, individual body parts, you know, and thinking about the foot, which is always the, you know, famous thing you think of there. I mean, that there's definitely a parallel there between that and glove from the film. This idea of this sort of like isolated body part having a life of its own within the animation, like a disruptor within the animation as
well.
The other thing I like about the Eleanor Rigby sequence is because we've just been introduced to Pepperland in itself, and then we see the stark contrast with the Eleanor Rigby sequence, you're already introduced to the idea of there's going to be different types of animation style in this film.
Yeah,
and I like that because it kind of sets up this idea that you don't know what to expect from the film, which I think it does keep constantly surprising you as you watch it.
Yeah,
I like that the Eleanor Rigby sequence was created from pictures of the art team that were making it at the time. So a lot of the people you see on the screen are actually people who worked on the film that had their photos taken and animated in. And my other favourite part of that whole sequence is after the Eleanor Rigby sequence, the young Fred goes to meet the Beatles, convince them to come with him to get in the Yellow Submarine. And as the Yellow Submarine launches, you have, do you remember there's like a series of shots of almost like leaving Liverpool and London.
Yeah, they're postcards kind of.
They are all postcards. Yeah, oh, okay. I love that. So there's a series of postcards that were then sort of almost like acting like a flicker book of, you know, showing you leaving, I guess, like the skyline.
Yeah.
Into what then becomes the next part of the journey.
Yeah, yeah.
To start us all, it's another example of how individual sections within this film were picked up by different animators, who then just brought a a completely new creative idea to each one. And what you end up is a mashup of different styles and techniques.
Yeah, yeah. Actually, that sequence that uses the postcards when the Yellow Submarine is launching also uses the a day in the life.
That's right.
The orchestral thing where everyone's going up to reach their highest note. And actually, there was a film it was Magic Christian, wasn't it? I think you used that as well.
It did, that's right,
And so, Magic Christian being, a year after this.
Well, Magic Christian didn't use the orchestral, rise. There was a shot when they came out of the Magic Christian boat and realised that they were in London.
Mm.
The realisation of that comes with that last note.
Oh, the big chord.
Yes, at the end, yeah.
Oh, okay. It feels to me like... It's quite cinematic, it's been used in a film, so therefore it's cinematic. But what I'm trying to say is, without meaning to, they've created something that perfectly encapsulates through sound the idea of sort of careening towards, sort of spinning further and further out of control and careening towards something and not knowing where you're going to end up. It's quite scary in a way, it can be very, very unsettling hearing that music. It makes complete sense.
You're right. It makes complete sense for that sequence because, again, I think it speaks of the unpredictability of the film because you don't know what you're heading towards when you hear that music.
Yeah, yeah.
One other sequence I wanted to call out, I don't know if you have any others, but one other sequence I wanted to call out was the When I'm 64 sequence because I think it might even be my favourite one in the whole film because I enjoy that it comes up with just a sentence of explanation as to how many minutes there are in 64 years.
Yeah.
And then it says, a minute is a long time, we'll demonstrate. And the O in demonstrate then changes to a 1 and a 2 and a 3. And then you have this sequence of counting from 0 to 60.
Yeah.
And each set of 10 numbers within the 60 seconds is animated in a different way.
Yeah.
Whilst other stuff is happening around it as well. I think that it seems to me like they would have given different animators a set of numbers to deliver in whatever style they choose, which is what's happened.
Yeah.
But also, I think, I don't really know how this relates in terms of timings with the pop art movement, but it feels to me like this film has a lot of words and letters and numbers that appear on screen in artistic ways that feels familiar to that genre of art.
Yeah.
I wonder how often before this film's released you'd have this level of animation applied to typography and what I consider to be more like a graphical design element.
Yeah.
You've got these big words like no written on the on the hills in Pepperland with in perspective, big block letters and things like that, and it's quite striking.
Yeah, definitely the way that sequence plays out with the numbers appearing on the screen in different ways is it seems to me a pretty clear influence on Sesame Street. Street I think starts in the early 70s. I'm going to say about 72 or something like that. Really reminded me of the pinball sequence in Sesame Street. I can tell you don't remember this, but that's fine. There's a pinball going round, and it goes 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12, and they're showing you the numbers on the screen.
1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12.
Before my time.
Yeah.
whereas Yellow Submarine, right in my ballpark.
And I think Sesame Street has lots of that stuff, putting numbers on screen in a way that is sort of artistically satisfying as well as...
educational.
As well as educational, yeah.
Yeah, interesting, yeah. And I guess maybe that also speaks to the appeal to kids with this film as well, because there is, it's easy to track those sequences.
Yeah. I think like that When I'm 64 sequence also, it's a really good example of the way the songs are used as a musical uses songs, i.e. there is a narrative problem that the characters solve through singing a song.
Yeah.
So through whatever mechanism it is, where they're traveling the wrong way through time, and then John sort of sets the, I think they've been de-aged, and then John sets the clock going the right way again, but it goes too fast, so they start aging and growing really long beards very quickly, and then they start singing When I'm 64, which effectively solves the problem.
Mm,
like the yeah. singing of the song solves the problem. And like the lyrics don't need to address the fact that we are aging and we need to address this problem. It's that the singing of a song that is thematically like on the same lines is it like gets them past it, and that's enough.
You know? Yes. Yeah. Yeah.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
We've talked a lot about the music and the animation and the voice cast.
Mm.
We haven't yet talked about the brief time we actually see the Beatles actually in the film.
Yeah.
Right at the very end. First of all, here's a question for you. Is it enough?
Well, I mean, so apparently they were quite detached from the whole process of the making of the film. When they saw the first cut of it, or whatever version they saw, they liked it a lot, and they volunteered to film this quick thing in order to be in the film at the end. So they filmed it on 25th of January 1968. This is about 3 weeks before they go to Rishikesh for the first time. So, you know, you get the impression this is just one of those things where they can just go to a film studio for a day, film this and be done with it, you know?
Yeah.
And, it's enough for me, yeah. I mean, there's the interesting question to consider with Yellow Submarine is, like, does it suffer for their not being involved more? Would it have been better if they had done the voices themselves?
I don't think it would have mattered, would it? Do you think?
No, I don't think it would have mattered. Actually, I think there probably would have been a fair bit of the dialogue that they probably wouldn't have wanted to do.
Yeah,
true. Interesting thing about... So the script, I think, was initially a bit too sort of American. Roger McGough, sort of Liverpool poet, who was also a bandmate of Mike McCartney in The Scaffold, brought in to sort of scouse up the dialogue a bit, which he did. So I guess, you know, the sort of the wordplay, I guess, comes from him.
And there's a lot of that.
There's lots and lots of that, you know. And so, like, these are bits of wordplay that aren't necessarily puns. They are bits where these sort of playing with opposites, you know, where George sort of says to Ringo, is there a matter you'd like to bring up or down? That kind of thing, where, like, it's a lot like how McCartney apparently wrote Hello, Goodbye lyrically, is just taking opposites.
My favourite in the film was when they reached the foothills of the headlands.
Yeah.
Just really like that.
Yeah. So those things are neat, but I feel like if the Beatles themselves had been given that script, as we were saying in the previous episode, the Yellow Submarine has contributed to caricatures of the Beatles, and in particular the way the Beatles speak, that persist to this day. And I think if it actually had been them speaking themselves, that would not have happened in quite the same way. So I don't think they would have been too keen on doing the script as it was. I think a lot of those kind of scousisms they probably would have thought rang a little bit flat.
Yeah, sure.
Because, I mean, in a live-action film, they would have been able to ad-lib that a little
exactly,
bit.
Exactly, yeah.
You can't ad-lib in when you're recording voice for animation. Maybe you can a bit.
As is the case, you get the impression they've ad-libbed the sequence at the end when they do appear.
Yeah.
There's a lot of that. There's a lot of... like sometimes you can feel a little bit impenetrable. Do you find this like when they're sort of riffing off each other?
Yeah.
And I kind of feel like this is it's almost a bit clicky, you know? Yeah. Like
it makes you feel like Michael Lindsay Hogg, doesn't it? Like,
yes. Yes, exactly. Yeah. But I like the sequence at the end. I like when Ringo says that he has a hole in his pocket. Well, half a hole. I gave the other bit to Jeremy.
Yeah.
And John goes extremely extra with his there are more blue meanies in the vicinity of this theatre.
Yeah.
I kind of like it because it feels a little bit like they are set apart from the film itself, but just connected enough to... like I think we're all in the joke when they come on screen.
Yes.
Right? The idea that the adventure we've just seen was actually them, and look, here are some props to prove it. Like, we've got the motor.
Yeah.
And
stuff.
But we are in on the joke because we know that that's not the case, and we get to laugh with them for pretending that that's what happened.
Mm.
You know, like I think that's I think the reason why that part of the film works is because it feels like we are joining in the joke with the Beatles.
Yes,
and it's just a bit madcap, isn't it? It's just them just going a bit crazy for what is probably about 40 seconds.
Yeah, right, exactly. There's so much of their previous film work you could categorize under general mucking about, you know.
Yeah.
And they were excellent at mucking about, you know.
Yeah, very much.
It actually makes me wonder a little bit on the subject of mucking about, how much the makers of Yellow Submarine had sort of, when Magical Mystery Tour came out, which would have been in the middle of them making this film, watched that and thought, oh God, good. This has very little narrative structure. Everything's a bit weird and psychedelic.
That's true.
Like the thing we've been doing fits with this quite closely.
Yeah.
Phew, what a relief.
But here's a question for you. Magical Mystery Tour, when it came out, critically reviled.
Yeah.
Yellow Submarine, not so.
Yep.
What do we think the difference is between wider the receptions of the two films?
So I think the fact that it's an animation creates a little bit of necessary distance. So at the time, post-Magical Mystery Tour, it's obviously their first sort of big critical flop. And then I think with them sort of going off to India and the general perception that they're getting a bit weird now, I think the press are not the biggest Beatles fans at the time. You know, they are getting a bit of a slagging. Yellow Submarine allows you to get away with more because it's a cartoon. So, like, things that the problems that people would have seen in Magical Mystery Tour, which is, you know, there for all to see, really, like it has no real narrative structure or cohesion to speak of, you could aim the same argument at Yellow Submarine. The fact that it's a cartoon, it allows you to get away with that a bit more easily, I suppose.
I suppose you're right. I guess there's probably a little bit more narrative for Yellow Submarine, isn't there? There is an overall plot of blue meanies and they need to be vanquished.
Yep.
I do wonder if, because it's an animation, you almost have the defence of saying, well, it's for kids, even though it's not really, as we've established, and we don't think it was made with that necessarily in mind.
Yeah.
But I think audiences at the time and critics at the time would forgive it a lot on the basis that, you know, maybe the intention was for it to be for a different audience.
Yeah.
Which just means it gets away with, being a bit silly on that basis, even though it wasn't technically true at the time.
Yeah, yeah. I think maybe also Yellow Submarine, it contains new songs, but also contains a lot of songs that the public already know.
Yes.
And like a lot.
That's true. Yeah.
So it's got Eleanor Rigby and it's got All You Need Is Love and it's got whatever else, but like the songs that people, Nowhere Man, you know, so songs that the public have already heard and are familiar with. So I suppose maybe it feels, it's a bit more of a sort of comfort blanket in that element of, oh good, okay, I know this one, I like this song, you know, I can go along with this. Not, you know, as we discussed in the Magical Mystery Tour episode, But hearing some of those Magical Mystery Tour songs for the first time, some of which are quite challenging, you know.
Yeah.
You know, things like Blue Jay Way, you know, let's say, you know.
Yeah.
I can imagine like that must have been a slightly sour note for people who were not that into it already, you know. Whereas this, you know, this has lots of songs that you know and you can sing along to, not least Yellow Submarine itself.
Yes, of course, yeah. Yeah, I think you're right. I think it makes the film a lot more accessible than Magical Mystery Tour was and still is. we talked a little bit before about how the film is actually groundbreaking and is cited as an influence for a lot of sort of modern filmmakers and modern animators now. I think John Lasseter of Pixar, so you know, he was directly responsible for the early Pixar movies like Toy Story, and so he's always said that the Yellow Submarine was a big influence on him as an animator. So I think because of the film's accessibility and because of how groundbreaking it was and this legacy that it then has afforded filmmakers working today, it means that it holds a sort of certain cachet that Magical Mystery Tour doesn't have.
Yeah.
A really clear proof point of that is no one's ever tried to remake Magical Mystery Tour.
That is true.
But there were plans to remake Yellow Submarine.
Yes.
So in 2009, I think it was first announced that Robert Zemeckis was going to remake Yellow Submarine.
Yep.
Ultimately, that fell apart, I think. So it got quite far in pre-production, at least. So he'd cast all the voices. I think most notably, for me at least, Peter Serafinovich was cast as Paul.
Yeah.
Have we had this conversation before? Am I right in thinking that you think that Peter Serafinovich is very good at doing all of the individual Beatles voices?
Yeah, his John Lennon is probably the best John Lennon impression I've heard.
That's right.
In that thing that like we often say about Ian Hart doing mainly the more acerbic version of how John spoke, Serafinovich can really do the sort of softer, more funny, playful version of him as well. Like, it's really spot on.
And yet he was cast as Paul.
Yeah. A misstep, yeah.
And I think we even mentioned before on a previous episode about the tribute act Fab Four.
Mm-hmm.
They were cast as the template to animate the band as they were playing his song.
Because this was going to be sort of mainly motion capture technology, you know.
Yes.
So it's worth explaining that Robert Zemeckis had this studio or studio imprint called Image Movies Digital, which was producing things like the Polar Express. Then he produced there was a version of A Christmas Carol. And a film called Mars Needs Moms.
Yes, Moms, yes.
which didn't do so well. But I think the public kind of ultimately rejected this technology. You know, if you watch Polar Express, it's got some lovely elements to it, but I don't know. There are bits of it where I can see where there's a sort of attempt to make things look a bit too human in a way that just doesn't quite like it's not recognizably human, it's not recognizably a cartoon.
It's certainly, if it's not where the phrase was invented, it's certainly what popularized the phrase Uncanny Valley,
right?
Like this idea of Polar Express starring a train conductor who happened to be wearing the skinned face of Tom Hanks as a mask. Like,
what you think children wouldn't like this,
but peeking out behind that face with dead glass eyes,
yeah.
And I think that by all accounts, the Yellow Submarine as a remake got halted because of the box office performance of those films not being as high as Disney wanted.
Mm.
But at the same time, the reaction to that motion capture and that overall look of that type of animation not being quite up to scratch. So yeah. There was a real critical backlash against that sort of motion capture look and it being a bit creepy.
Yeah. And I think maybe they were a bit unlucky in that, in terms of where the technology was at the time, that was kind of what it could achieve.
Yes.
And so probably anyone trying to take this technology forward saying, hey, this is the big new thing, was probably going to crash and burn as it was. But they weren't that far away in years from the motion capture technology we have now.
No, absolutely not. No, and you know, they think of motion capture being used, you know, in terms of Lords of the Rings films, obviously, any Andy Serkis film like The Rise of the Planet of the Apes, and probably also most recently Avatar. We need James Cameron to be making a remaking Yellow Submarine.
Yeah.
I want
the
Yellow Submarine to turn up in Pandora and Avatar Way of Water.
Yeah.
In many ways, the Na'vi were the real blue meanies of... Going back to the casting of Robert Zemeckis' ill-fated Yellow Submarine remake, a couple of other interesting names are in the mix. Cary Elwes was cast as...
George Harrison?
It was cast as George, was he? Yeah. Okay, so Cary Elwes, you'll know mostly from Princess Bride, but also he was in Robin Hood Men in Tights and the very first Saw movie. He's been in a whole bunch of stuff. But also most interesting to me as a Doctor Who fan is David Tennant was in talks to voice the Chief Blue Meanie, which I think would have been quite fun.
Oh, right, okay.
I think he's, you know, it's kind of actor that can really go all out in a role like that and, you know, really like chew the scenery and do all those things that you want sort of actors to do when they're playing like a bit of a wild card character.
Yeah, I suppose the whole idea of remaking a Beatles film, obviously, if you're going to do it, Yellow Submarine is the only one you really could do. You know, you can't...
I love the idea of trying to remake Hard Day's Night with different people as the Beatles.
Right, exactly. You know, yeah, I mean, like whatever approach you took to that, you would lose the magic that they brought to it. So I think if there was a Yellow Submarine remake, as we said, that sort of motion capture technology has sort of come on leaps and bounds. So actually, like, that technology is now being used to sort of put actors who have died or actors who are older and de-aging them to sort of put them in films to appear younger or to appear alive. So you think of Robert De Niro being de-aged in The Irishman, and you think...
Indiana Jones, Harrison Ford in the new Indiana Jones movie, has been de-aged significantly in that film for a whole sequence at the start of the film.
Really?
So we're recording this at a time when that hasn't been released yet, but the whole first sequence in that movie is of Indiana Jones as he is in the first movie, Raiders of the Lost Ark. And so in the trailer you can see shots of Harrison Ford de-aged and he looks exactly as he did.
Really?
Then. It's really good.
Wow, okay.
And Marvel used the de-aging technology a lot, obviously, for a lot of their characters. So Michael Douglas is obviously older in the Ant-Man films, but there are some scenes of him from back in like the 80s and he's been de-aged to look exactly as he did as Gordon Gekko.
Yeah.
It's just great. Like, really, really brilliant.
Yeah, yeah.
Really brilliant use of that technology, and it always looks pretty flawless, I think.
Yeah, yeah. So, you could produce a new Yellow Submarine. You could produce a new Hard Day's Night if you wanted to, but by getting actors to play John and George, getting Paul and Ringo to play themselves and de-aging them. I mean, the sheer amount of effort you would have to put into it does raise the question, what's the point?
Yeah, why? Yeah.
and I think not just the effort, but what is the point anyway?
Well, but the interesting thing about that is because I think there would be an argument for remaking Yellow Submarine if you're going to do something interesting with it.
Yeah.
You know, because as wonderfully imaginative as all of the animation is on Yellow Submarine, the film is still restricted to the technology that it had at its disposal at that time and to its budget that it had, which was obviously very low at the time. But if you're going to remake a film like that, where you can let your imagination run wild and you have the budget and the technology to really, you know, bring out some of those wonderful elements in full 3D, CGI, photorealistic, then I guess there's an argument that would be quite an interesting experience.
Yeah.
You know, in answer to the question, why would you need to?
Yeah.
Maybe that is an answer. Like, maybe to introduce the film and those songs to a new audience in a way that, you know, my kids probably wouldn't sit and watch Yellow Submarine, 1968 Yellow Submarine, but maybe they would be interested in watching 2023's Yellow Submarine. I feel like you're not happy about that at all.
I've never liked your kids.
I tell you what, Robert Zemeckis is going to be kicking himself if it turns out Peter Jackson's next project is a remake of Yellow Submarine.
Yeah, inevitably.
Right, Right, I think we should probably leave things there. I think we've just about covered everything we wanted to discuss about 1968's Yellow Submarine. I hope you've enjoyed listening to this two-part episode. That is it for this episode, but it's also it for this season of the Beatles Films Podcast. We will be back again for another season soon, but until then, we would urge everyone to follow us on all the usual social media platforms at Beatles Films Pod, to not only find out when we will be returning with a new roster of films to discuss, but also to be the first to find out about a few other special episodes we've got coming up very soon. In the meantime, if you've enjoyed any of the episodes in this season or previous seasons or this two-part discussion on the Yellow Submarine, please feel free to leave us a review or a five-star rating on your podcast listening platform of choice. Otherwise, we'll see you again very soon. And until then, bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And is all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hey, everyone. Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.